Hi, I'm Dr. Sunny Ravencourt from the University of Coruscant, and when I can't find reliable information for a lecture,
I steal it from the Jedi Temple Archive podcast.
Seriously, I do. Their security is terrible. There's like one old lady running the whole place.
This podcast is a member of the Red 5 Network. For more Red 5 Network podcasts and content creators, visit bio.link/red5.
There is more knowledge here than anywhere else in the galaxy. Only members of the Jedi Council are allowed access. Guarding the holocrons is one of the most important duties a Jedi can be given. Do you think you're up to the task?
Star Wars fans, welcome to another episode of the Jedi Temple Archives podcast. I'm your host, Rob, and we're recording this episode on Thursday, March 30th, 2023. All right, welcome back. Glad to have everyone back here. I know that I'm excited to be back recording again. Unfortunately, I do not have my normal co-pilot, Tom, but I went down to the local cantina and found a few mercenaries that were willing to jump on board for tonight's discussion. And I've got for you Ro Gazga from the Scarif Scuttlebutt podcast, Ro, leader of the Red 5 Network and good friend, as well as Pat from Conversations podcast, half of Pat and Charles, the Bert and Ernie, the Star Wars Bert and Ernie of the podcast world, apparently, according to Cam Ray. We can always thank him for that, but glad to have both of you guys on the show tonight. Thanks so much for joining me to talk about Mount Tantus and its importance in the Star Wars galaxy.
Oh, it's so good to be here with you too. Pat, how you doing?
Bert, I am doing pretty well. I'm good, man. I am I'm good. It's been kind of a crazy week, crazy time for me, but this sort of banter always sets the course right for me. So I am good to go, man.
Excellent. This is like our therapy, and Rob charges by the 50-minute increment, so let's get to it.
Right. Yeah, I got to have 10 minutes to make my notes and make sure that that I keep everything recorded for the next session. But no, I wanted to talk about Mount Tantus. This is one of the things that is interesting to me about The Bad Batch. It's not a series that I think hits on every episode for me. And obviously, we are going to be talking about the end of season one, a lot of season two of The Bad Batch, and then kind of rolling back into some of the references from Star Wars Legends or the Expanded Universe, if you prefer. So if you have not seen season two of Bad Batch, but intend to watch it, there will be spoilers here. So just be aware of that going in. But, you know, one of the interesting touch points that we have seen within season two of The Bad Batch, and it was really introduced right at the end of season one, is this Mount Tantus, this facility, Imperial facility. It's kind of a hidden, secretive Imperial facility. Within the Bad Batch, it is used as the home of the Advanced Science Division, and they are experimenting with clone troopers and working on some clandestine cloning activities, which very much ties into, you know, what we had seen in the EU, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But what were your guys' thoughts when you saw Mount Tantus? Did you realize its importance? I don't know how much you know about the EU. And what are your thoughts about its arc within the Bad Batch this season? I'll start with Ro.
I had a quick question. I know at the end of what season one, have they actually called it by the name?
Yeah, they did. I don't think they did at the end of season one. They definitely did within season two. And the second I saw it, the first thing that popped into my head was, oh my God, that's Mount Tantus. And so, you know, we know they love to throw those Easter eggs out there for the people who are, you know, students of the lore. Probably has less importance maybe to some of the folks that are just watching Bad Batch, but I'll throw it back to you, Ro.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think I love the fact that that Filoni is kind of picking, you know, a little bit here, a little bit there to kind of expand really an area of Star Wars that we have not yet explored, at least in modern canon, I guess, if you will. But, you know, for those of us that kind of experienced some of that, you know, from the expanded universe or the Thrawn trilogy, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's a nice surprise. I think it, I don't know, as a fan, I feel rewarded for knowing, all this minutia and the fact that it's kind of popping back up. You know, I feel like I'm a part of the elite.
Yeah, completely agree. There's definitely a payoff there if you know it. There's certainly no downside if you're not a fan that is familiar with it. And certainly, it, you know, it comes out of books that came out of the early 90s. So if you're a newer Star Wars fan or someone who came to it in the prequel trilogy, certainly something you could have easily missed. But some cool ties, and there are definitely hinting about some of those, you know, threads that they could potentially be pulling from the EU and some interesting places that could go, and we'll have that conversation a little down the line. But, you know, Pat, what were your thoughts? I know you came to Star Wars a little bit later than Ro and I did, being a young lad yourself.
Well, not too young. I actually read The Heir to the Empire when it came out.
Oh, nice.
I was in high school, I'm middle school. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. So I did read it when it came out, and so I was aware of it from then. And then this interesting thing happens when Disney takes over and takes most of that stuff and says, hey, remember that stuff that happened in the dark times of Star Wars that was really cool? It didn't happen. So you feel slighted as a fan because you're like, man, I love that stuff. I love the Heir to the Empire, I love the Shadows of the Empire, all that stuff that was kind of new, different, and a fun continuation of the story we love. And then to have that be like, well, you know, it was a fever dream of Han Solo and Carbonite or some cheapening of it.
Right.
So to start to see that stuff come back and be legitimized in present day canon is really a very cool thing. And like Ro was saying, you know about these things and you kind of have to reconcile, okay, well, you know, it was a great story, but now I guess it doesn't count. And then now it does, which is great because they're strong, fantastic stories.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, it was a different time within Star Wars. I mean, we live in an age right now where there is Star Wars around every corner. There's new shows coming out, maybe not so much the movies, which, you know, they've kind of had trouble getting a lot of those off the ground. But we've certainly been able to see plenty of Star Wars within the theaters and with the advent of streaming, you know, via Disney Plus.
There's so much Star Wars. I'm getting so fatigued. Oh my God.
Right. Star Wars fatigue. It's the big threat to everybody. You know, but you look at what the time was back in the early 90s. We had wrapped up the original trilogy. There was no plans for any additional Star Wars. There were some comics that had come out. I know the Dark Forces comics were probably one of the very first things that I had been exposed to after Return of the Jedi had come out. And we had Splinter of the Mind's Eye, you know, kind of when the movies were coming out. But there was a period of time where we thought Star Wars was done. And it was so formative for a lot of us, especially the older fans. And to have the Thrawn trilogy come out, Timothy Zahn did an amazing job with that three novel series. And in a lot of ways, it was expected that that would have been episodes 7, 8, and 9 at the time. And you get this amazing villain in Thrawn, and we won't go, you know, I'm not going to go into his entire backstory. I've got an entire episode or two episodes actually dedicated to him. But he is a great villain. We get to see him in Rebels. You know, we've seen him in novels, and he was very closely tied with Mount Tantus. And so now that we have the Ahsoka series coming out, and you know, there's a lot of talk that Thrawn will tie into that. It's going to be interesting to see a lot of what they pull forward. But that expanded universe was really all we had, and it's not surprising that so many fans were so strongly attracted to that and had such strong feelings about it. I understand that there were some continuity issues that came out of that because there were so many authors involved, even with a story group, you know, Lucasfilm kind of tying it all together at the core, but. The reality was there was a lot of wonderful content there and a lot of things that were worth saving. And it is so great to see that stuff being brought back into the light by Disney.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that always has interested me now that Star Wars is, you know, reaching a point where, you know, the IP is so expansive, you know, obviously growing up with the original trilogy, you know, you just had three movies, you know, maybe a comic book here and there. But now, I mean, there is so much to keep track of.
Yeah.
There is so much to really dive into. And, you know, when you talk to, I guess when, you know, as we grow older, we start to see new fans kind of come in to Star Wars at a different place in the lore. Whether they're coming in through animation or, you know, some other, you know, part of Star Wars. It's interesting to me because there are folks, obviously, you know, we just dropped an episode on our channel about the Solo movie.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you how many people were confused at the end of Solo when Darth Maul, spoilers, popped up. That, you know, I was excited to see him again. And obviously being able to have absorbed the continuation of Darth Maul through the animated shows, you know, I knew what was going on. But there was a lot of people, there were a lot of people that were around me, you know, friends even, that are not into Star Wars as much as I am. You know, they love Star Wars, but they're not animation watchers.
Sure.
You know, it was confusing. So it was nice to kind of give them a little tour of really what had happened to Darth Maul after Obi-Wan, you know, departed him from his bottom half.
Yeah. Made him half the man he used to be.
Right.
Yeah. So it's interesting just seeing, you know, how much or how the fans are reacting to all the stuff that we're getting. And then, you know, and like you said, just having story elements being introduced from the expanded universe into new canon. It's kind of cool to see.
Yeah. And I would say that, you know, that they have done a good job of drawing some direct parallels between what we saw in the EU and what we see within the Bad Batch. It's absolutely this clandestine facility. It's a location that is kind of off the grid for most of the Empire. You've got Tarkin, you've got, spoiler alert, Krennic in the two episode finale.
That was,
you know,
cool.
You see some cool, you know, some parallels for this is kind of where, if you were involved in one of the Emperor's secret projects, you would be based out of. And that very much, you know, parallels what we saw within the expanded universe. This was, again, it was one of Palpatine's secret storehouses. Even within Battlefront 2, you know, there's a side mission in Battlefront 2 where you play as Luke Skywalker and you are tracking down one of these secret facilities where he finds this hyperspace compass that then, of course, shows up when you see him, you know, in the flashbacks. I believe it was on Kylo Ren's bedside table in one of the flashbacks. It was in Luke's possession, certainly within the time frame of The Last Jedi. And so, you know, this is where when the Empire would find these critical bits of Force lore or Force knowledge, that he would store those there, and he also loved to store his trophies there. So, you know, we will see. They're using it more in the Bad Batch as kind of a base of cloning operations, where they're doing some experimentation on these clone troopers. I believe they have Nala Se, who was one of the lone survivors of the Kaminoan massacre at the end of season one. So they're very much, you know, tying it into the cloning, and that is an important aspect of what happened on that same facility or at that same facility in the EU.
It's interesting to see kind of that one part of it, because there was a visual I found online. It's like a schematic of Mount Tantus. Yeah. And, you know, there's several levels and sub-levels, and, you know, the Emperor's chamber, and then like his trophy room. Right. And then, of course, the like where they kept the cloning cylinders and stuff like that down towards the bottom. So all that kind of stuff is just, we're scratching the surface in visual media right now. And it'll be really interesting to dive into that in some manner on screen. And I feel like we got a little bit of that through the Kenobi series when he's down in that crypt.
Yeah.
And you see in the Fortress Inquisitorius there. Mm-hmm. And you see some of those beings on display.
Yeah.
I feel like we're going to get some, that kind of style of trophy room somewhere in the mount.
Even within the chamber where the Inquisitors would meet, there was lightsabers basically from their vanquished foes that were over on the windowsill. So displaying their trophies was a very Sith thing to do. Not that they were Sith, but they certainly were taking, you have to believe they were taking their cues from Palpatine. That was their ultimate desire.
Yeah. And the children's helmets were kind of chilling.
Oh yeah. The younglings.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Head not included.
Let's hope not.
Thankfully. But yeah, I mean, there were definitely, you know, within the current Star Wars canon, you're looking at the Kaminoans who were producing these clone troopers. It was about a 10-year period for them to grow these clones, and they would imprint them with the training and some of the skills, I guess, of their host and a lot of the personality, I think, as well. But within the EU, these Sparty cloning cylinders that were part of this Mount Tantus facility within the EU, those would actually allow for the cloning of troops within about a year's time frame. And then once you work Thrawn into the equation, you know, he is this master tactician, incredibly intelligent. Within the EU, they also had these creatures called the Salmiri, which were lizards, basically, but they could project this force-negating bubble. It's not that the force didn't exist, but you couldn't use the force within that bubble. And I thought that was, by all accounts, Thrawn, the idea of Thrawn having access to these and these creatures even existing was one of the very first things that Timothy Zahn had thought of when he got signed to do this series. And it's a great way to take characters that have these essentially superhero abilities and negate them. It's the kryptonite to a Jedi, right? So, they could be used to essentially cut off these cloning cylinders from the Force. And Thrawn was growing these troopers in like 2 to 3 weeks as opposed to a year, which when you think about it, I mean, talk about a tactical advantage. It's not just turning out these clankers that were these inept battle droids. He could actually turn out fully equipped and capable troopers within a very short period of time and equip his own army.
Yeah, but then like you had mentioned previously with the 10-year growth period in a clone on Kamino, mm-hmm. in Attack of the Clones, we're seeing them at different stages of their lives.
True.
Where they're, you know, as children being trained with technology and then with combat and essentially like flight simulators, all those types of things that they would need, you know, as a soldier, they're being taught that over the course of these 10 years. Whereas, you know, these clones that they were making at Mount Tantus had to be essentially downloaded.
Yeah.
That neural information had to be implanted in because they were ready within a year. So it's like you have to have almost like a software update to just kind of, you know, implant into these clone brains to make them function like the Matrix, kind of.
Yeah, I mean, they called it flash pumping, and I equate that very much. I think the Matrix analogy is perfect. I very much equate it with that, where they were just basically, I know Kung Fu, right? so, it was kind of like the Matrix before the Matrix existed. And you almost wonder if they kind of riffed off that a little bit, if they had some of that background. But no, there were so many things about that Mount Tantus facility and the capabilities of it, from the cloning to the Imperial storehouse of all of Palpatine's trophies. And we'll kind of get into what those trophies were in just a couple minutes and their importance. And even those, I think, have some threads that could fill in downstream to the sequel trilogy. But within the current storylines that we see within Mandalorian, within the Bad Batch, you know, we've already seen one of these potential cloning facilities on Nevarro in season two of The Mandalorian, where they kind of had some maybe failed attempts to create a Snoke or to create what would eventually be the resurgence of Palpatine. And I know a lot of people found that to be, you know, kind of a cop-out, I guess, within the sequel trilogy. But again, going back to those Dark Forces comics that came out not long after the original trilogy was completed, those were based upon Palpatine and his kind of contingency plan that if he was killed, he was going to be able to take his Force presence and insert that into one of these clones he had at the ready and continue on and, you know, unbeknownst to the rebellion.
Yeah, I think one of the things that people forget is that Palpatine, obviously, we always talk about how Palpatine is always, you know, five steps ahead of everybody else. Right. But, you know, even I know there's a little bit of controversy when it comes to the, I guess, the birth of Anakin and his relationship to, you know, whether Palpatine kind of influenced the midichlorians to create life because sure. he learned it from his master. I want to think that that is what actually happened, because Palpatine is always trying to unlock the secrets of immortality. We see it throughout the saga. Mm-hmm. He wants to be able to control life. He wants to be able to live forever and have his empire reign, you know, for a very long time. So I think the fact that Anakin was burned to a crisp kind of put the kibosh on some of his plans.
Yeah.
I think Palpatine understood that Anakin really would have been a very, very powerful Sith.
Yeah.
If things didn't go south, and the ability to be able to, like we see in the Dark Horse comic books, the ability to be able to jump bodies and just to kind of maintain the strength of Anakin, but have his essence, you know, Palpatine's essence in his body.
Right.
I think that's one of the things that he has always wanted to do ever since he, his master, Darth Plagueis whispered that into his ear.
Yeah.
So he's been on that road for a really long time. We obviously see him playing with a little bit of those dark arts towards the tail end of the Rebels animated show, where we see him kind of playing with that magic and kind of coming to the realization that there is something more than the cloning ability. Let me kind of put my hands in this cauldron to see what's up over here. So I find it fascinating. And I think, you know, as much as we kind of poo-poo on the sequel trilogy, you know, there is kind of a little bit of a thread when it comes to somehow Palpatine surviving.
Right. Yeah. I mean, very much in keeping with what was established very early on past the original trilogy. And I think that, you know, there's certainly fans out there that know that lore in depth that maybe weren't surprised to see Palpatine come back. But he was always, as you said, five steps ahead. He was always looking out for himself, and he was, you know, he was able to predict the future, but he was also making sure that he had a contingency if things didn't work out. And that Mount Tantus facility was very much about that. The cloning cylinders, you know, one of the trophies that we should talk about that he kept there was the severed hand of Luke Skywalker with the Anakin Skywalker lightsaber, right? So we do see that show up again within The Force Awakens. There's a big gap in terms of what the backstory was. How did Maz Kanata come up with this particular Skywalker relic? And now that Mount Tantus is in the mix, it would have been very in keeping with Palpatine to keep something like that. Certainly with cloning, he would have been able to potentially recreate Luke Skywalker with, or even Anakin, you know, Ro, to your point about how powerful Anakin was. But you know what, the mindset that if Luke was truly powerful enough to defeat Vader, then certainly Luke might be a candidate for creating a vessel for his Sith presence to fall in. Oh boy, Pat's laughing.
If only there was a storyline in the expanded universe that included a cloned Luke Skywalker.
Oh, I know, right? The reference that Pat's making there, we've got a Jedi Master named Joris Sabath, or Sabath, depending on how you like to pronounce it, who had been part of a outbound flight project put on by the Republic back in their heyday. And he had actually died, but he had been cloned. And one of the problems with cloning Jedi within the expanded universe was they tended to go mad. Very, very Saw Gerrera, right? With the boar gullet. But you ended up getting these cloned Jedi. And in the case of, the way that they identified them within the novels was they always had a W, right? So Joris was J-O-R-U-U-S, and they ended up using the hand of Luke Skywalker to clone Luke. He ended up having to fight his own clone within that expanded universe, which was pretty epic, and ties into a whole storyline with Mara Jade, who was an assassin of Palpatine, who ended up becoming the wife of Luke. There were so many great storylines, so many great characters that they created. I mean, even just within that initial trilogy, so many characters that had through lines through the entire expanded universe. But it's cool to see that now that Mount Tantus is back, it is opening the door for some explanation of things like, how did Maz get that Skywalker lightsaber? How is cloning gonna factor into the storyline? As we see, it certainly provides a through line to how Palpatine would return. But, are there any other, tidbits with Mount Tantus and how you think that may tie into the story in the seasons to come?
There might be a little bit of twisting and turning as far as adjusting the expanded universe story. Now that we're getting, we'll be getting Thrawn in the Ahsoka series. His name obviously was mentioned. His presence was hinted at in the last few episodes of The Mandalorian. And I still will proclaim that a shot of him is going to be what ends the season as a cliffhanger.
I like it.
So we'll see if that happens. But if it does, I'll be right. But it's I think there's a lot of different ways that that storyline can go. Now that we have Mount Tantus and we've got Thrawn, I mean, there's definitely some things that can be utilized in this new canon if they kind of keep to the archaeological aspect of the Empire when it comes to the relics that are stored there. And it's too bad that the sequel trilogy did not utilize some of these elements to kind of fortify the storytelling of the sequels. They're doing that now for whatever reason and for what it's worth. But I feel that it's kind of for me the sequels are kind of sticky, as you know. But we'll see what happens. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the crazy things is if they can wipe out the entire expanded universe and that becomes Legends, I would say no current canon is safe, including the sequel trilogy, if they determine that they've come up with a better storyline. So, we'll see if that actually plays out. But, certainly within, the overarching saga of Star Wars as they're putting it on the screen right now, I definitely think that they've got the opening to do some really cool stuff with the Ahsoka series. And I have no doubt that they're going to work some threads, whether it's Mount Tantus or some of the ancillary things that come out of that into the other series that they've got forthcoming. So Pat, overall, within Mount Tantus, what were some of your favorite aspects of that particular facility, both within the EU and kind of how they're translating that into the current storyline?
Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that Ro just mentioned archaeology and Tantus, and how if you stand at a certain spot in the map room with the forget it. So I couldn't help it. I I like the like the elite Imperial commandos that are guarding it, and how they're like the almost the special forces that are keeping all that under wraps and everything. But I mean, it would be cool to have a guardian,
yeah,
there in some capacity, or even a reference to that would be pretty neat in visual canon. But I think that the idea of this Royce Hemlock,
yeah,
character,
yeah,
you've got this military mastermind in Thrawn, and you know he's we've introduced him in canonical animation,
mm-hmm,
and he'll be around in live action soon enough. But I think to have, if you're going to have that as a base of several different operations, military operation, you have Thrawn.
Yep.
And then for scientific operations, he's like the perfect fit to head these questionable scientific operations.
Oh, yeah. I think his morality is definitely for sale to the highest bidder. You know, he's certainly looking out for himself. But with regard to the Guardian, right, you know, within the EU, technically the Guardian, some sort of dark Jedi, they never really explain what happens to him. Mm-hmm. But the assumption is that by the time Luke finds Wayland, which is the planet that Mount Tantus is on, he runs across Joris Sabaeth. And that is basically one of the things, you know, for Luke, he is at the time the person who is charged with resurrecting the Jedi Order. And he finally comes across this Jedi who has all this amazing force knowledge. He wants to be able to defer to him, but there's something off about the guy, right? And now we are seeing, even within the current timeline, not necessarily within a show, not within any of the you know, the content they're putting out through Disney Plus or a potential movie, but Jedi Survivor, right? There is, mm-hmm, some being, some human, that is found within a stasis tube of some sort by Cal Kestis, in some of the limited footage that's been put out. And there's a lot of conjecture that that may be Joris Sabaeth, right? So we will see, I guess, when Jedi Survivor comes out here in a little under a month, I think, at this point. But, you know, they've done a really good job, I would say, with some of the games that they put out, of tying those into the through lines that they're putting out within the content of the shows. And I wouldn't be surprised if there is some sort of backstory or explanation of who that is, and if that is another tie to Mount Tantus.
I mean, it makes sense to kind of thread all of those storylines, not necessarily together, but close to each other,
mm-hmm,
because there's certainly been some things in the Disney Plus series. So you've got Mandalorian and Bad Batch releasing literally at the same time. And there's a lot of hints at storylines,
yeah,
that are pertainable to both of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as you watch the one and then you watch the other, there's sort of reinforcement of those key elements in both those series that you can kind of see what they're building in those two parts of the timeline,
mm-hmm,
to bring these things into reality that we've either seen in comics or read in books, and see where they pertain to this part in the timeline.
Yeah, I was interested, you know, the current episode of Mandalorian, we are getting more and more indications that Gideon never was put to trial, somehow escaped. And one of the things that crops up with this Mount Tantus reference is one of the items in the EU that Thrawn had acquired by having access to Mount Tantus was he got the cloaking technology that they had ended up using on a lot of those Imperial ships, which would give them a tactical advantage. And, you know, now we've seen that Gideon has somehow been broken free. You know, obviously the blame for this has now been put potentially on the Mandalorians with that piece of Beskar alloy that gets found in the shuttle. But it kind of hints that there may be larger forces at play here, and it almost it would be explainable to say that, you know, Thrawn had somehow busted him free with some sort of a cloak ship laying siege to that particular shuttle as it tried to take Gideon to justice.
Do you think the Mandalorians would be that stupid to leave shards of Beskar behind?
No.
Clearly, it's a plant.
World's worst frame job.
Yeah, like, obviously.
So let me ask you this. There's a few accounts that come to mind that might claim that you guys are giving Lucasfilm writers a little too much credit for saying that it's a plant.
Agreed.
Okay.
Or do you take that?
God, I hope it is.
Yeah. Do you take that clue as, you know, as face value? Is it actual a shard of adamantium or whatever the hell
it is? Wolverine did it. Wolverine did it.
It's vibranium.
Yes, it is.
Wolverine did it. Wakanda forever.
Bob, you're coming with me. It's not really good motivation for the Mandalorians to take him, other than to kill him, in which case they would have killed him.
Yeah. God, it's, you know, I would love to be a fly on the wall in the writer's room. I think
I would love to be at the table in the writer's room.
I'm fairly certain that some of the flies on the wall in the writer's room are writing some of this. But
I knew something witty was coming.
Right.
Yeah, it's I would probably say that we're probably overthinking it, and it's probably something that the writers should be doing instead of us as fans. But I don't know. I'm going to take it as face value. I'm going to make it. I feel that the story is simplistic, and it's kind of a what you see is what you get, We'll see what happens at the end of the season, but you're right. What is the motivation of breaking him out? Other than, you know, let's get some revenge and get this guy for whatever reason. Or, I mean, even if it's the big baddie Thrawn who breaks him out, why? And then why would he want to frame the Mandalorians for doing it?
Right.
Yes, yeah, it's so beneath him.
Yeah, to be determined. One of the interesting things, and as it ties into the writing, because I think you make a great point, I think that Favreau and Filoni, their influence on the overall writing is to take these big pieces that are the through lines that tie things together, the cartilage, if you will, of these episodes across these multiple shows. They're the ones that propose this, and they hand it off to a writing staff that then has to turn that into a story.
Explain it.
And it's those individuals that are struggling that I don't think have the overall knowledge of the series that end up with some of these stories that feel very thin. But again, the fact that you have these big threads that tie multiple shows together and tie back to important events and important locations, those I feel like are the influence of especially Filoni. I mean, he understands things kind of along the lines of what Lucas had in mind and some of the larger story points. I just think that there's not a certain attention to detail at the low level of writing to make sure that those always turn into a quality story. That's a whole nother conversation that we probably don't need to get into here. But no, I think that you're absolutely right. I think that, certainly the idea of this Beskar alloy planted in the shuttle, maybe planted, maybe not. It was one thing to let us draw a conclusion. It was another thing to have someone blurt out, "Hey, must be a Mandalorian." let's make sure we point that out. But
let's drive this one home at all costs.
Right, right, right. And going back to the original topic, you know, you look at something like Mount Tantus as a major component in the story. It's something that ties back to something in lore, as we've been talking about. It'll be interesting to see what threads they pluck out of that as things worthy of exploring in the new canon. What things do they leave behind? I don't expect to see a cloned Luke Skywalker. I don't expect, necessarily to see thousands of troopers being cloned at this facility, although that seems to definitely be what they're looking for. And there's certain aspect of these troopers, you know, these they kind of look like a clone stormtrooper hybrid, but they've got that it's almost like, you know, they're looking at some sort of video on the inside of their helmets. you know, some sort of mind control going on there. It's very, very strange, very different from the other, you know, main thread troopers that we see.
That's the brilliance of the clone trooper is they'll do what you want.
Right.
And as an empire, when you're enlisting humanoids to be in your army, they've got their own ideas, their ideals, their agendas, all that which can compromise them to your ultimate goal.
Yeah.
So if you can take that sort of physical specimen and duplicate that, but yeah, then imprint your own ideologies onto the subject and multiple subjects, then you have what you had in the clones with a longer lifespan and you know, without the risk of them defecting and all that. Now, the question I have is, while we're on the topic of stormtroopers, if they're going to take a Zillow beast and they're going to try and like genetically harvest its armor skin,
mm-hmm,
like, why don't you throw that stuff on some stormtrooper armor so that every blast that nicks him in the shin doesn't kill him?
Stop making sense, Pat. You wild man. What are you trying to do? Make stormtroopers invulnerable? No, I think it was actually Royce Hemlock in this past episode who was talking about the fact that under the leadership of the Jedi, that the clone troopers had developed a disturbing level of individuality. And that goes exactly to your point, right? Right. So, I think part of what they're trying to do is they're trying to take the clone template, as you pointed out, you know, he has a use for these clone troopers that can no longer be relied on. Use that as the genetic material. And like you said, wipe out what made them individuals, make them absolutely just, you know, stamp them out. They're going to be loyal to the end, the perfect fighting force. And it's kind of a different approach than we saw with the quote-unquote stormtrooper program that Tarkin was advocating for, where they were conscripting these people from the planets that they were in control of, and basically, you know, running them through the conditioning that the Empire used to create their stormtrooper program.
Now Ro has a thought. Let me ask you guys this. Do you guys think that Hemlock has been experimenting on himself?
Mm.
Because, you know, he to subdue Crosshair, didn't he flood the room with some sort of gas, and he's just walked in and started to sniff it like if it was, you know, whatever, and it didn't really affect him. So it's almost like he's kind of
he dread, you know, Pirate Roberts, Tim.
Yes,
There you go. So yeah, I mean, that's kind of an interesting thing, you know, going back to this whole notion that you know, the whole mad scientist aspect of cloning at this facility is disturbing, but it's a story plot point that that should be disturbing because of Palpatine's directives. If indeed, you know, he is kind of running things here, especially for the, you know, the purposes that he claims to have, you know, get this done or get me somebody that'll do it for me. I need it quick and I need it fast.
Yeah. It's an interesting point that I hadn't thought of, but you know, you look at Palpatine and now he's willing to do anything within his power or anyone else's to stay alive and stay in power. And I think it's that sort of mindset that leads to these ambitious people running these programs. So I think Hemlock is in that same vein of, like, you know, that sort of God complex.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously being a human, he's not a god. And if he can augment or improve himself after testing it on quote unquote willing clone subjects, of course, and then once it's proven to be a success, then yeah, of course, using it on himself to have that
power and that greater sense of self-worth, because he obviously is inflated anyway.
Yeah, and we talk about Palpatine and the fact that he was always looking out for himself. He had clearly a plan to be able to figure out how to create clone that he could transfer his essence into. We see that not only within some of the storyline within the EU, but also within what we saw within Rise of Skywalker. And one of the interesting things, you were talking earlier, Pat, about within Mount Tantus, that he had this throne room kind of at the top of the facility, and he had a turbo lift right out of that throne room that led directly to a personal hangar that was coded directly to his retinal scan that he could use to escape that facility if it were ever compromised. And he always had, as Ro made the point earlier, he was always five steps ahead of everyone. He was always looking out for making sure that he had a way out of any scenario, even though we saw within the prequel trilogy and within so many of the novels that came out. We look at the Darth Plagueis novel that came out that's now also part of the EU. He was always thinking that he was superior to everyone around him. He was always thinking that he had this vision that would allow him to predict what was going on. And yet he still made sure that he had a plan B, escape plan, so that even if he were wrong, if he were fallible, that he had another way out. And certainly very Sith. We know that they were always the stronger of the two shall survive. And he took out his own master, and his expectation was if he trained an apprentice that at some point they would try to do the same to him. And he was not about to let that happen. I think he thought he was going to be the prime Sith. He was going to survive forever. He was going to discover this pathway to immortality. And Mount Tantus was very closely tied into that mindset.
Absolutely. I just wanted to also point out that we've been talking about this for about almost an hour, 56 minutes, and yep, No one has said the word discordant.
Until now.
Right. I was trying not to be discordant and mention that. I know that's Ro's word of the week that turned into his word of the year and may end up turning into his word of the decade. I may have overused that at one point.
But, it's getting back to the conversation. The stash that Palpatine has in the in Mount Tantus and Pat, I'm looking at the very same diagram that you mentioned earlier on in the episode. Mm-hmm. in the show here. There is there's so much stuff there that I think, from a writing perspective, from a creative standpoint, you can kind of, create whatever you want that characters can go back in there and find, or something that might have been stolen from that, getting back to an archaeological standpoint that maybe somebody came in and, stole it from this facility. Mm. And kind of reintroduced it into, the general population. I think the sky's the limit when it comes to the drama or the narratives that can kind of go hand in hand with this sort of thing. And I think it's cool. I think the sequel trilogy, like I said, had an issue. I think the Knights of Ren would have been an amazing way to kind of reintroduce all that stuff. I really wanted them to be dark side or Sith artifact hunters.
Yeah.
And that would have been an amazing tie-in to Mount Tantus to kind of help reintroduce the idea of Palpatine coming back, other than just writing a line for Poe and explaining it all away.
Right. When are we going to get that Indiana Starkiller spinoff?
Yes.
Right. No, but I completely agree with regard to, having Force sensitive relic hunters would have been very cool. I know that, one of the issues within the EU, Thrawn certainly had access to the facility. He had the ability to take what he would need from it. And when I think of the issues that he had was the fact that he wasn't force sensitive, and most of what Palpatine would have collected, you know, there would have been Sith holocrons, Jedi holocrons. There was a Book of the Sith that he had basically compiled from all of the learnings and knowledge that he had accrued, pulling together various, you know, aspects of things all the way back to even Darth Bane. So there would have been a lot of things, a lot of value within that storehouse that a Force user would have been able to glean that Thrawn was really not privy to.
Now, in the EU, Luke, after the mount is,
are we talking
destroyed,
about Luke, or are we talking about Luke?
No, we're talking about Luke. Luke, okay. Skywalker. You know, commander in the Rebel Alliance. Right. You know, that guy. You know, just him. So, in, you know, after Mount Tantus was destroyed in the EU, Luke's like going through the rubble and he finds the Book of Sith, right? Yeah. And I would imagine he had it in his possession at the time. Now, wouldn't it be interesting if that were one of the books that he had on Octo?
Ooh.
Yeah. Like I said, I think the right hand wasn't communicating with the left hand when it comes to Star Wars lore here. So. Yeah.
No, I definitely agree that there are endless storylines that you can pull out that would take a particular item and leverage that into a great storyline. It wouldn't require any characters that necessarily anyone knows of. You know, there is an entire book that is about a force sensitive youth who becomes basically a quote unquote force collector. And like Rose said, you know, the Knights of Ren, I think there was a lot of opportunity there for them to have been dark side relic hunters. There were certainly within some of the novels, I think it was the Wendig novels, where there were a group of acolytes that were hunting down dark side artifacts. You know, there's a lot of things there that I think would appeal to the fandom. Whether a story ever comes of them or not, who knows? But I would love to see some great stories that don't involve Tatooine, or one of
droids. You don't like the sand?
Yeah, one of the four droids that apparently exist in the universe. There are R2 droids everywhere.
Hey, you know, nothing beats a good astromech, okay?
I agree. All right, so, you know, wrapping it up, any other points you guys want to bring up about Mount Tantus before we end the conversation?
I just, I hope that they bring out more of the lore that was forgotten back in the EU. I think it's interesting. I think, you know, it'll go a long way to make this era of Star Wars a little more interesting. It truly deserves kind of a rich tapestry of there's my other Indiana Jones reference. Tapestry.
Right, a rich tapestry.
There you tapestries.
Go. We have many tapestries.
If you want to count, I am Mickey Mouse. Oh, no.
But, yeah, I'm looking forward to more surprises on Mount Tantus.
Yeah, I think there will be.
Now, do you think that they may use the ruins of Mount Tantus as a Republic safe house during the Yuuzhan Vong War?
Oh, boy. Now we're going deep into the EU.
Okay. Do you have another hour?
Whoops.
We don't want to get into the Yuuzhan Vong.
We're going to put that Loth cat back in the bag.
Yeah, we don't want to get into the Yuuzhan Vong war and the death of Chewbacca because that's just going to upset everybody.
No, all right.
Yeah, I agree with Ro. I think that there are endless stories that could come out of a tie-in to Mount Tantus. We will wait and see. I think that certainly the cloning aspect is what they're leading into the hardest. I don't know that we're necessarily going to get a ton of relics that Palpatine was storing. I know that even within the EU, there were a lot of those items that were hidden within caverns, and which even, you know, the Republic forces, Luke and Han and, you know, the Republic folks that storm that. Oh, Sith holocrons, perhaps, as Rose holding up. You know, a lot of those relics weren't even known to be there or found by the rebels that came in and destroyed that facility. But, you know, the storylines are endless. Their importance of that particular location, I'm glad that they embrace that within the Bad Batch. You know, one of the things I said to my wife the other day was, you know, she wasn't a huge fan of the Bad Batch. She hasn't been keeping up with it. We've been watching Mando, and I said, honestly, I said there is more interesting stuff coming out of the Bad Batch right now than I'm seeing in Mando. And that's not to say that I don't think the Mandalorians are interesting. I definitely do. But some of these deep cuts that really appeal to old school fans are really coming more out of the animated stuff. And to Ro's point, you know, people that haven't gotten into the animated series, I say this when I'm talking with Tom all the time, the Clone Wars, Bad Batch, to a certain extent, and then Rebels, absolutely. And mm-hmm. and there was an awesome nod to Rebels within this week's Mando episode with the appearance of Zeb, which is if you're a Rebels fan, a really cool cameo. There are so many great stories that they did tell in the animated series, and I just every day I hope that more and more of that type of storytelling makes its way into the live action world.
Absolutely.
Yep. Yep. So, guys, thank you so much for joining me tonight. I know it's kind of a topic that maybe is off a lot of people's radar. I know that there's going to be people out there who are Mando fans that haven't been watching The Bad Batch. Hopefully this gets you to kind of go over and check out that storyline. You're going to like certain characters more than others, maybe. But there are a lot of great tie-ins. We do get a lot of tie-ins with Saw Gerrera, which is always a beautiful thing. He has bylines through a lot of the Star Wars content that we've seen. And, you know, the overall storylines, I think, are going to be important to even events that we see within Mando and certainly within Ahsoka. I really do believe that. So definitely go check it out if you have any interest in that at all. And otherwise, you can tune in here and we'll talk about it here, and you can kind of get the Cliff's Notes version. So, Ro, Pat, thank you guys so much. Why don't you each tell us where folks can find you and your podcast, and we'll lead it off with Ro.
Sure. So you can find me talking Star Wars and other nerdy stuff on the Scare Scuttlebutt podcast. Just lift your head up and aim towards the smart speaker embedded in your wall and say, "Hey Siri, play the latest Scare of Scuttlebutt podcast." Oh, she just asked me what? Too funny.
She's so
what
attentive.
Scare of Scuttlebutt podcast. Oh
no. And
but yeah, yeah, wherever you find your other favorite podcast, there we will be as well.
Yeah, definitely check out Ro. Definitely check out the Red 5 Network, red5network.com. You can find a lot of other great podcasts, good friends, and certainly members of family. And speaking of family, Pat, why don't you go ahead and let us know where we can find you and Charles and the Conversations podcast?
Well, if you've already found a solace with the Red 5 Network, you will find us there as part of the bio.link/red5. We're also on our website at conversations.com. We're on the Facebooks, the Twitters, the Instas, the whole bit. But we do have a link tree at link.tree/conversations with links to all of that good, wonderful content. You get me and my wonderful Canadian co-host, and maybe too many references to the Jedi Temple archivist himself, Rob LeBarry.
I figured I better have an episode out there so I could actually still be referenced. Yeah, definitely check out Pat and Charles and the Conversations podcast. Definitely check out the Scarif Scuttlebutt podcast. And if you're into some really cool dioramas with action figures, don't tell Charles I said that. there is an awesome link on the Conversations website where they do some really awesome mock-ups, and certainly they're both into cosplay as well. I know that last year at ScarifCon, Pat and Charles were stars of the show. So check out, oh boy, we've even got
nice.
Cards, trading cards from our good friends over at the Rebel Base card. So anyway, guys, thank you so much for joining me to talk about this awesome topic, and looking forward to seeing you guys both hopefully this summer or fall whenever we get ScarifCon 5 ironed out.
It's coming.
It always is.
That's what she said.
Hey-o.
Awesome. And if you're looking for us, you can find us at jtapodcast.com. We put on an episode at least once every 3 months. But we're going to go back to an every other week format. So we're going to get back in the game. Let my friends actually remain my friends. My family actually remain my family. But anyway, you can find us on socials at JTA Podcast, and you can reach us via email at jtapodcast@gmail.com. So with that being said, you guys, may the force be with you, and have an amazing week.